Check your six. In the move out of Afghanistan, the United States left something behind. Millions of dollars worth of military equipment and more than 100 U.S. citizens. But, and it's a big one, America may just have some pretty fierce leverage over the Taliban still. Then if you are out and about in New Orleans and you're not a first responder, you'd better get home fast. If your home is not there, at least get off the streets. New tonight, New Orleans declares a curfew, and Louisiana's governor tells evacuees to stay where you are. Don't come back. Not just yet, anyway. And later, he was named Jeopardy's new host and then stepped down amidst all the controversy. Now he's been booted as the show's executive producer, too. And all of it for jokes he made 7 years ago. Is there a statute of limitations on offensive comments? All that tonight on Banfield. Welcome to Banfield. It is August 31st, 2021, President Biden's deadline for the full U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and it is official. The final U.S. service member has left Kabul. America's longest war is over, so why doesn't it feel like it's over? There were no flowery speeches. There was no ticker tape parade, no kisses in Times Square, not this time. This time, all we're left with is thousands of fallen American troops in Afghanistan that is less secure than when America first routed the Taliban 20 years ago. And lingering doubts about why we were even there in that country in the first place. Oh, and we also have between 100 and 200 U.S. citizens still in country, still in Afghanistan, still in harm's way. Still at the mercy of members of the Taliban, like this Taliban soldier, seen in this exclusive video that we obtained from some local press there, whipping a man trying to make it to the airport. This was just a few days ago before that airport actually stopped running. Hundreds of Americans stranded in Afghanistan. That was a frightening prospect when the U.S. military controlled the airport. But now that we don't have a single foothold in the country, it is downright horrifying. Take a look at this video shared locally showing Taliban soldiers fanning out right across their newly established Achkaya airport and sizing up all the damage that was done to the U.S. Black Hawks and other military aircraft after the U.S. forces destroyed them right before they left. The person on camera here is saying, "There is nothing left, totally rendered and disabled. These traitors have destroyed everything. Look at all these Black Hawks. Traitors have destroyed them. These were our nation's investment." And yet the Biden administration seems confident. Here's U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on GMA this morning.
Well, first, as General McKenzie said yesterday, we continue our mission to get them out. It's just that it has shifted from a military mission to a diplomatic mission. And we have considerable leverage over the Taliban to ensure that any remaining American citizen will be able to get out.
Diplomacy with the Taliban. A few months ago, that just would have sounded crazy. But the Biden administration seems to think it just might work. And the reason, that magic word that you heard, leverage, it has become the rallying cry for the Biden administration. This week, there's a lot of talk about it. In fact, here's the president from just today.
The Taliban has made public commitments, broadcast on television and radio across Afghanistan, on safe passage for anyone wanting to leave, including those who worked alongside Americans. We don't take them by their word alone, but by their actions. And we have leverage to make sure those commitments are met.
Haha, what is that leverage, you say, that the United States has over the Taliban? It starts with M and sounds like millions. I'm joined by two people who can help us get to the bottom of this question. Sam Donaldson has covered some of the biggest stories during his more than 40 years with ABC News, including his time as White House correspondent. And Senator Bob Kerry served this country as a United States Navy SEAL and later as governor and senator from Nebraska. He served in the Senate with President Biden and endorsed him for president. Senator Kerry was also a member of the Federal 9/11 Commission. Gentlemen, thank you to both of you for starting us off tonight. Senator Kerry, I'd like to begin with you because there's some breaking news that just came in from Reuters, and I'll just read it for you. It says that the United States last week gave authorization to the U.S. and its partners to continue to facilitate humanitarian assistance in Afghanistan, even though the Taliban is blacklisted by Washington. So I'm wondering, Senator Kerry, if this is this newfound leverage slash diplomacy that everybody's talking about.
Well, first of all, there's lots of not-for-profits in Afghanistan. And you know, I hear people say, why didn't we move faster? We've been warning people to get out of Afghanistan since March. They certainly had a strong signal when former President Trump negotiated an agreement that included releasing 5,000 Taliban prisoners. But it was likely that the Taliban was going to be coming back to power. I mean, I think there's ample evidence to indicate that we did about as good a job as you could once you made the decision to get out, and we're now out. And we were spending close to $200 million a day in Afghanistan. I actually didn't support leaving Afghanistan, but now that we're out, the question now is, what do we do? And I think when you've got the Security Council of the United Nations and 100 nations as well saying we want safe passage for everybody coming and going in Afghanistan, it's not just that we have leverage with financial assets that we get tied up in U.S. banks, but we have political leverage. So, you know, I think this is the unmitigated disaster that it's being portrayed constantly. It doesn't make me feel terribly good because you're quite right. There's no celebrations or ticker tape parades that are occurring as a result of our withdrawal. Yeah.
The political leverage is one thing, and I want to stick with the financial leverage because there are a couple of other statistics that I have found fascinating. One representative from Massachusetts, Jake Auchincloss, cited some figures this week which I thought were interesting. 90% of foreign reserves for Afghanistan are located in United States banks. That's leverage. And 75% of the government was actually funded by international donors. So, Sam Donaldson, is this the way typically in all the years that you have seen wars come to an end, the military aspect of a war shifts to the diplomacy aspect of a war with dollars and pressure?
Well, that's true. But of course, in Vietnam's case, the deal was made. Let us out. Don't force us out. 1973, we got out. All of our prisoners got out from Hanoi. Waited a decent interval. Then, 2 years later, then North Vietnam took over the South. Of course, Bob Kerry knows about this. He was their Navy SEAL in that war. He won the Congressional Medal of Honor, the highest award we have for bravery under enemy fire. So he can tell us more about how it feels to be in a never-ending war. I give President Biden an A+ on his final exam, which was getting out of Afghanistan. I think like almost every American, we want to help. We want to get all of our people out. We want to help the people who've helped us get them out. And we want to see if we can't work with the Taliban, if in fact it has changed its stripes. This tiger, this leopard, I don't know about that. But we can do what we can outside. But we cannot stay. If we didn't stay, we're not going to lose another American.
There are, you know, plenty of differing opinions on, you know, these last few weeks and how we actually exited. Many point to, you know, closing out Bagram before all the civilians were home. And there were reasons given for that they had to choose one, and they chose Ajkaya because it was closer to where the civilians were. So that's a debatable topic. But Senator Kerry, I want to show some video of the Taliban members inspecting some of the U.S. equipment at the airport, obviously damaged. But you can sometimes fix that if you have that money. And we've been talking about the financial leverage that the United States and the international community can have over Afghanistan. I wonder if some of that financial leverage in those dollars might go towards repairing some of this equipment or, God forbid, buying some more equipment.
Oh, I don't think it's going to be easy for the Taliban to repair those helicopters and get them flying again. The bigger concern for me is how they can continue to fund themselves as they have for the last 20 years, growing and selling opium. Obviously, they're not going to be taking people hostage and threatening people and raising money that way, but it is the number one grower of opium in the world. And they've been generating a lot of money to fund their war effort through sale of opium. So I actually think it's far more we have many more concerns that are more serious than are they going to be able to get Apache helicopters put back together. I think the odds of that are pretty darn low. Because they can't just, you know, patch them up. They got to be able to maintain and fly them, and that is not an easy thing to do.
Well, I will say, when I was in Afghanistan in the early 2000s, I saw a lot of Russian aircraft flying around that were, you know, put together with baling wire and masking tape, and they seemed to keep them flying, you know, for a decade or two. So that was a fascinating epiphany for me. I want to show you some other video that we obtained today, and this is really interesting because this gets right down to street level and the Afghan that just wants to go to the ATM. And yes, they have ATMs. So this is showing long lines for the banking in Kabul. And one particular video has a translation that I'll just have to read for you because it tells you the story that they're dealing with. It says, this is Azizi Bank in Kabul. Look at the large number of people lined up outside the bank waiting to withdraw money from the ATM. This is a situation under the Islamic Emirates of Taliban. Look at this situation. The narrator who's videotaping this, obviously, could grave peril to himself to be videotaping this. So the reporting locally is that they have limits now on what they're allowed to withdraw from their own accounts in the banks. And Sam, again, from all your reporting, this is probably not surprising that the Taliban finds itself with a lack of hard currency in the country and not a whole lot coming in. So they're kind of seizing what they've got. How long does that usually last? And is there, you know, obviously a rush on the banks, as you can see. Will that have any effect on the Taliban?
Well, how long will it take for the Taliban to form a government? I mean, we don't have a government in Afghanistan at the moment. They say maybe by the end of the week, they'll have a provisional government going. They're still fighting in the north. There are still Afghans who are loyal to the old system, if you will, in the mountains above Kabul that turned them back yesterday. Now, they'll eventually, the Taliban will succeed in, I guess, unifying the country. Although Afghanistan, as you know, you've been there, is not the average country where, hey, people, let's all get together under a central government. That doesn't work. They have their own individual governments in their own individual provinces. I think forming a new government in Afghanistan is one of the biggest problems. And that will add to your question, which I can't answer tonight, about the banks and the money and if life can return to some sort of financial normal. But I'll say this, if I may. That is, we went to Afghanistan and we hadn't paid attention to the country before that to get Osama bin Laden and try to stop terrorism from that country. We're leaving Afghanistan, and I must tell you, I agree with the president in a sense. He was saying, folks, around the world, we have problems. For instance, Iran has started its subterfuges again to make an atomic weapon, folks. And what about Iraq? We're still paying a price for not being able to tame Iraq. You're going to tame Iraq or Syria. And think of China. China is the danger. Folks, if you have young children, teach them English, teach them Spanish, and then Mandarin Chinese. They're going to need it. So when you look at
well, and there's going to be, you know, some of that leverage is probably going to come from the Chinese and the Russians and maybe the Iranians. But Senator Kerry, there was something interesting about the revelations that the president made today, and that is that many of those Americans left behind are dual citizens, which begged the question, if they're dual citizens, it's not like they can just buy a ticket and get out, because that means that to the Taliban, they're traitors and they're Afghans, so they can't get out the normal way. You as a Navy SEAL would know, I think, the best answer to this question. That is some rugged terrain in Afghanistan. And I am wondering if you think there are going to be myriad special ops rescue operations somewhere around the White Mountains or in Nangarhar or in that, you know, disputed territory between Pakistan and Afghanistan that's lawless to get those people out because they're not going to be able to go the conventional way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's no question as long as the airport is closed down, there'll be a lot of people moving to the east and trying to get out through Pakistan. That is undoubtedly the case. And again, you've got the Security Council of the United Nations has not been supportive of what we've been doing over there, and now they are. We've got 100 countries that are now paying attention to people coming and going in Afghanistan. And you know, I see all these guys wandering around the streets of Kabul with AK-47s. You don't govern a country with AK-47s. You better figure out how to run your schools, run your health department, keep your transportation. I mean, it's running a government is not easy. And I think they're going to have a heck of a time getting it done. And by the way, I don't think that lines of people from an ATM should cause us to want to intervene. There are lines of people in Lebanon right now trying to buy food, and we didn't cause that. There are lines of people in Venezuela. We can't just use the suffering of the individuals in the country. Right now, the Taliban have to deliver. And I got to say, I'm deeply skeptical of their capacity to be able to get that done.
Yeah, well, they need money, They certainly need some help fighting ISIS-K, so that, you know, that's where America has some strength. So maybe there'll be this bizarre common alliance. Senator Bob Kerrey and Sam Donaldson, thank you both for your time.
Sam, it's great to see you.
Great to see you, Bob, and congratulations.
I second that. That's nice, having a little party at the end of our segment. Thank you, guys. I look forward to having you both back.
Okay.
I'm going to stay on the story. The gloves were off during President Biden's briefing today. He accused former Afghan President Ghani of malfeasance and corruption when he fled the country, reportedly with about $169 million in cash and cars. So why did the United States government and President Biden trust him at all for any of these years that he's been around? Up next, a writer who thinks there was a vast criminal racket in Afghanistan from the very get-go, and that America, all administrations that were involved in this, may have played a part. Plus, will the CIA plan those secret rescue ops now that the military is gone? And how hard would that be? Welcome back to our special coverage of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. This morning, we were greeted by a pretty shocking headline in Vanity Fair. A vast criminal racket. How the U.S. corrupted Afghanistan. We're lucky enough to have the writer of the article tonight, a journalist who spent more than 15 months in Afghanistan and has seen it go in and out of Taliban control. Sebastian Younger is with us. Hi, Sebastian. It's nice to see you again. I want to, you know, gosh, it's a long article and it's a hard first question, but effectively it's hard to hear it as Americans that we corrupted that country. It kind of seemed already pretty corrupt. Explain the headline.
Yeah, I didn't write the headline. I'd rather move on to what I said in the article. Yeah, it was a very corrupt government, and there's a real tradition of that. When the Taliban came in 1996, I was in Kabul in 96, and I remember a guy saying to me, we're going to let them in, even though we hate them, because they're going to clean up corruption in this country. And when the Taliban came in to Kabul, the first thing they did was arrest President Najibullah and hang him from a streetlight for corruption. And then what happened after the U.S. got there is they kept feeding that corruption. Billions and billions of dollars went into Afghanistan, and the money was never really monitored. It wasn't regulated. And so there would be these sort of grotesquely overpriced development projects, and a huge amount of it would go to the governor, and he'd become a multimillionaire. And just none of it, there was really no oversight. And so, of course, the Afghans were watching this and thinking, you're giving us exactly the same kind of corrupt government that we had before, that the Taliban cleaned up. Like, what, you know, why we don't want this. We want a decent government. And the Taliban, for all of their brutal policies, at least were a clean government. They were not corrupt. And that meant a lot in Afghanistan.
So does it make it harder? And it's hard to hear that. And I remember people telling me, you know, as awful as it was with the Taliban, at least they ended the civil war and they weren't corrupt. Americans feel very different about them, you know. But does it make it harder for Americans to do what we were talking about in the segment before? And that is to use money to leverage what they want, meaning they want Americans out and they want ISIS-K looked after, and they don't want any terrorism to be fomented in that country again. Does it help that they're not corrupt?
Well, I mean, look, back in 96 and 97, 98, Al-Qaeda came in with a lot of money and bought their way into a secure position in Afghanistan. What I mean by corruption is the kind of corruption that afflicts ordinary Afghans when they go through a police checkpoint, when they have to go to a government office and file paperwork. I mean, look, even that some of the commanders and bureaucrats were taxing the soldiers, taking a portion of their salary as a huge corrupt scheme for the privilege of serving in uniform. I mean, supposedly we there were 300,000 Afghan soldiers that we stood up and spent a lot of money on, but the number actually wasn't anywhere close to that because a lot of them were so-called ghost soldiers, and you know, the missing paychecks were going to corrupt bureaucrats. So you know, I think at the end of the day, the Taliban actually might be easier, weirdly, might be easier to deal with on that level than the Afghan government was.
So weird.
I mean, we'll find out. Yeah.
So, okay, here's another very weird part, and you're going to have to follow the bouncing ball here, but there's a lot of local reporting and some photographs of convoys of U.S. military equipment that the Taliban is parading down to the Turkum border. And, you know, most people, if they don't know, the Turkum border is a very heavily crossed area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. So local reporting has the picture saying that these are American, you know, gear, military gear headed for Pakistan. We do have one local source that recognizes the Turkum border that has given some credence to that. And there's some Indian reporting that they're outraged in India that some of this extraordinary equipment is headed to Pakistan. Now, why would that be? And the prevailing wisdom would be, thank you, Pakistan, for helping us, Taliban folks, in our effort against, you know, America. Here's a little gift, some gear that you can point at India. This makes things really messy there, if it's true, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, the optics are messy. I mean, I'm not sure some Humvees are going to tip the balance of power between Pakistan and India. I mean, India holds the advantage there. I mean, one of the reasons Pakistan wants a compliant government in Afghanistan because they want a sort of a fallback position if India attacks them. I mean, geographically, they want a position to fall back to and fight from. You know, I mean, the Taliban were created by the ISI and are under the command of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. And the ISI might have said, that's some nice looking gear. We like the optics of this. Send it over. You know, you owe us. I mean, gift or demand, who knows? But either way, they clearly could have done this at night and no one would have known. They did it during the day because they want people to see the optics of this.
Speaking of Pakistan, the pictures you're looking at now is sort of like 2.0 refugee crisis. The Turkum border is jammed right now with refugees from Afghanistan begging to get out. I think we've got a comparative photo, if we can put it up, that shows what the Turkum border crossing looked like a week ago compared to what it looks like today. And it's, you know, it's really tragic to see this because, you know, back in 2000, Pakistan already had a million Afghan refugees. And so I can't imagine that they're too keen to open up, you know, the gates. Can we get that comparative photo if we can find it? I think it's really telling. I don't think they're too keen to open up the gates for more Afghans. What is going to happen to those people, Sebastian, if they can't leave through Pakistan?
Well, I don't know. There are ways of, obviously, there's ways of crossing. Yeah, and obviously there's ways of crossing that border. The Taliban went back and forth across that border and the Mujahideen before them, you know, very, very easily. So I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, one of the levers, you talk about leverage, one of the pressures on the Taliban is going to come from Pakistan because they don't want a refugee crisis. They don't want to absorb 100,000 people. And I think that, you know, one of the things they might say to the Taliban is, look, you have to act decently enough that you don't create an enormous exodus from your country because we do not want to deal with it. The Taliban also, you know, now they're a standing army, right? They used to be the insurgents. Now they need to hold territory. Now they have to have trench lines and outposts and all that other stuff that's so vulnerable when fighting an insurgency. What they don't want is to now fight their own insurgency in Afghanistan. So, I actually think they have to be quite careful about overreaching and overstepping right now.
Yeah, and I've got 10 seconds, but can you just comment on how rugged the terrain is in this country if U.S. Special Ops are going to be, you know, conducting any rescues anywhere in the hinterland outside of Kabul, how difficult that would be? You've been on the ground there. You know what it looks like.
I imagine they're going to be going in by helicopter as they did when they killed Osama bin Laden, in the other direction. So, it's brutally, brutally rugged terrain, and it's ideal for fighting an insurgency.
Yeah, boy, oh boy. Sebastian, it's great to talk to you. Thanks so much for your wisdom. Appreciate the time.
My pleasure.
We're on quite a delay, too, so thank you for that, for being so patient. I appreciate it. I'm going to switch gears for a moment and take you to the fact that we're 2 days out from a Cat 4 hurricane. Louisiana's governor says the most dangerous days are just beginning. And to those who fled, this warning.
If you have already evacuated, do not return here or elsewhere in southeast Louisiana until the Office of Emergency Preparedness tells you it is ready to receive you.
After a break, I'll be joined by a New Orleans resident that you may recognize on the latest disaster to strike his adopted hometown, Harry Shearer, live with us when we come back. Welcome back. Almost 2.5 days after slamming into South Louisiana, Ida is a shadow of her former self, but still threatening tens of millions of people with 4, 6, maybe even 8 inches of rain. And I'm talking to you, Washington and Pittsburgh, Philly, New York, Boston. Yeah, you. Back in the bayou, a dusk to dawn curfew is now in effect tonight in New Orleans, but mostly because there's still no electricity. And that might be just a problem for weeks, too. No electricity means, among other things, no streetlights, no traffic lights, and no air conditioning, which itself is a life-threatening condition in Louisiana in August. So far, at least 5 deaths are being blamed on Ida in Louisiana and Mississippi, not counting the 71-year-old Louisiana man who is currently missing and presumed killed by an alligator that had attacked him in the floodwaters. I want to bring in News Nation correspondent Brian Enten, who is covering the floods in Lafitte, Louisiana, on the New Orleans outskirts. And I'm also pleased to welcome longtime New Orleans resident who happens to know a thing or two about hurricanes, floods, and levees. Among his hundreds of other credits in TV, film, and radio, and the web, Harry Shearer wrote and directed the 2010 documentary The Big Uneasy, about the failures of New Orleans' flood control system in 2005. There's so much to talk about. First, a report from you, Brian. The strengthening of all those flood protection systems for New Orleans did not help the outskirts, you know, where you are. So take me there and tell me how these areas fared.
Well, it's awful, Ashley, not only here on the outskirts, but also in New Orleans. They may have not had the flooding, but you mentioned it. They have no power. The only reason you see us tonight is because we have a generator and a truck providing our lights. 1 million people, roughly, without power tonight. So no power, no water, no gas, no sewer. It's hot. It was 100 degrees today. And by the way, there's snakes and alligators in the water. We've seen them all day out here. So really, it's just a nightmare scenario for the people who live in this area.
So are you seeing actual people? What are they doing? Are they holed up in their homes? Have they evacuated? Like, what's the circumstance right now for them?
So a lot of people did leave. In New Orleans, the damage was not terrible. The floodgates held, as you mentioned, so there's not a lot of flooding. There wasn't a ton of structural damage, but again, no power, and it's so hot, and no water in most of the city. So people are just miserable. Imagine sitting in your house in 100 degrees and being told that the power might not come back on for a couple of weeks. So that's New Orleans. Where we are, Lafitte and these coastal areas outside New Orleans, you can see behind me, they're still flooded. The water has receded a bit today, but there's still a ton of water. The only way to get into these communities right now, Ashley, is with a boat.
Oh, gosh. You know, Brian, thank you very much for yeah, that's a hard job at 100 degrees doing what Brian's been doing all day and now late into the night. So thank you. Harry Scherer, I'm sure you're hearing that report. I'm sure that you're seeing these pictures, and I'm sure that you've seen all the pictures. So apart from the heartbreak, I just want to get your thoughts on the circumstances with your fellow countrymen down in Louisiana.
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Ashley. I think we're just getting over the stunningness of this happening literally to the day 16 years after the flood of 2005. And I think for most of us who aren't dealing with the instant problems of water in our houses, we're running a lowlight reel, of what it was like 16 years ago, day one, day two, day three. The advantage this time, of course, is, as your correspondent mentioned, is that New Orleans, at least, is not full of water as it was during the Katrina episode. And the United States Army Corps of Engineers, which built the old system, which failed in 2005, and then was given $14 billion by Congress and told, try again, do better this time, is bragging on the success of the new system. It did also brag about that success in 2012, the first time it was really challenged. And an engineer in New Orleans then did a Freedom of Information request for messages inside the Corps of Engineers during that hurricane, where they ended up losing all ground sensing information. So they didn't have any idea how high the water was in the canals that had, whose flood walls had failed in 2005. So I think we have to be a little cautious about the claims of success. I have a source inside the Corps of Engineers who has been warning me for years that this system will work unless it meets a hurricane with high rainfall. And you may recall in the days leading up to Ida's landfall, we were told it might be a high rainfall event. In the event, it was not. And that may have saved New Orleans bacon this time around.
So, gosh, Harry, I mean, it's depressing to hear this, because $14 billion is not chump change. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think the solution really is for not just New Orleans, by the way. You just saw Brian Enten was out in Lafitte, and all of these surrounding communities don't get the benefit of the flood protection that New Orleans gets. So what is the answer as climate continues to kick our ass and, you know, New Orleans is sinking?
Well, I mean, in terms of the outlying areas, which will probably not be covered by a levee system into the future just because of expense, because of benefit-cost ratios that the Army Corps of Engineers does, the state of Louisiana has a very expensive coastal restoration plan, and some of the money is coming from, in the strange ironies of life in Louisiana, the BP Deepwater Horizon disaster a few years ago.
Really? That's crazy.
Yes, it is. But in terms of what you were talking about, this problem goes farther than Louisiana. There are about 125 cities in the United States which are getting protection by the United States Army Corps of Engineers. And people who know this stuff really well have been looking at the Sacramento area as the next one to possibly have a problem with that protection. I think that unlike what happened after Katrina, we need a fairly thoroughgoing and tough investigation of the way the Army Corps of Engineers does this particular kind of work. There were two forensic engineering investigations into Katrina in 2005 and 2006 from UC Berkeley and LSU. And both of them pointed to the failures of the Army Corps of Engineers in building that old system. And one of the authors of the Berkeley report said, had that system been built properly, the worst that would have happened to New Orleans during Katrina would have been, quote, wet ankles, unquote. And they really escaped a serious governmental, that is to say, congressional scrutiny last time around. I think it's way past time.
You know, I always thought that our interview would be about The Simpsons and funny things. You know, I just interviewed Hank Azaria a couple of months ago. So will you come back another time and talk to me about things that are light and jovial and make us all feel great?
Sure.
You know what? You just did it. But I am going to hold you to that and ask you back again. Thank you. It's good to see you, Harry, and good luck with the huge job ahead, you know, in your hometown.
You're going to need it. Thank you.
You will indeed. Thank you for that. Coming up, after stepping down as the new host of Jeopardy, Mike Richards may have thought he put his controversy behind him, but the cancel mob was not done with him yet. We're going to talk to a good friend of his who happens to be a TV host himself. That's coming up next. And this is Mike Richards, who may just become the answer to a trivia question himself. And that question is, who replaced Alex Trebek as host of Jeopardy only to last five episodes before he was fired as both the host and the executive producer because of inappropriate jokes that he made 7 years prior? That doesn't fit on a question card, but you know the drill, right? This is all begging the question, is there a statute of limitations on offensive comments and jokes? I mean, 7 years? Joining us now, comedian Ben Glebe, who hosts Idiot Test on the Game Show Network and on Pluto as well, Pluto TV. And also with us is political commentator Ben Ferguson, host of the Ben Ferguson podcast. So, first of all, Ben Glebe, you are friends with Mike Richards. Have you had a chance to talk to him about this? Do you know how he's doing?
Yeah, he's a buddy of mine. We're not close friends, so I have not talked to him about it. I don't know how he's doing. I imagine this is a pretty horrible sequence of events in his life. He can't be happy about it. I think this is a tough situation, but I think he overall got a pretty raw deal on this thing.
Yeah, so Ben Ferguson, and I have to use last names because you're both Ben. You know, Sony's saying that he was fired because of a distraction. You know, they said, yeah, we had hoped that when Mike stepped down from the host position at the Jeopardy show, it would have minimized the disruption and internal difficulties we've all experienced these last few weeks. That has clearly not happened. That was their statement. But being fired for a distraction as opposed to the offenses, I'm getting a little confused about all this. Is this just easy language to get out of it?
Yeah, at this point, just all of the above, right? I mean, we live in a society now where I was talking to some college kids the other day in their class on Zoom, actually, and one of them asked for, like, career advice. I said, whatever you do, don't do any interviews that are non-essential to the future of your career. Don't do any shows for practice anymore that are archived on the internet. Don't say anything that you can't defend possibly 30 years from now. And if you are paranoid about it, thinking, well, I'm not even sure about 30 years from now, then just don't do it. I mean, the problem we have now is we have intolerance to humor or comedy. And I'm not even talking about his comments directly. I'm just saying in general in society. And there are people now out there that entire livelihoods revolve around trying to destroy people's careers and write articles about how they destroyed their career. And then they want you to pat them on the back. I have never seen so many of my colleagues say no to interviews. It's like tonight when I got the phone call from you guys. If I didn't know you personally, I probably wouldn't have agreed to come on tonight because I know you from our past history together doing TV. But now there's a real question. It's a risk-reward factor. Is this good for my career? Is it worth the risk? Is there something I might say that could cancel and ruin my entire life? And unfortunately now, because of this insanity, and it is insanity what we are doing in this country to people, we have now allowed the crazy TMZ, National Enquirer people that hide behind their computer screens to rule the world in this psychotic way to destroy people's lives. And I'm sick of it.
I do know you, Ashley, and I still almost didn't agree to come on today because you never know what words are going to be twisted in the future. It's so true.
Or taken out of context.
I
mean,
Yeah, I'm a comedian, and Mike Richards started as a comedian. He was on a comedic podcast. I tend to give comedians a lot of leeway when they speak, and when you're on the air live recording something or doing something live directly, you need to be given some leeway to say things. I mean, right there is Chelsea Handler, my old boss on Chelsea Lately. She says all kinds of crazy things and did in the past. I think we need a little bit of nuance.
I have to squeeze in a quick break. I do have to, but when we come back, I want you to finish that answer, because the best advice that, Mike Richards said he ever got was to, be himself. And I think, oh, my God.
No, burn every tape of everything you've ever done.
The answer is after the break. And the question is, do we have to go to break? And that is yes. So we'll be right back after this.
I had a number of people, my mom, my dad, my wife, and my kids tell me, Dad, don't put so much pressure on yourself. Just go have fun. And so that's what I took in, and that's what I did. I had a blast.
Ah, well, Ben Glebe, that sounds like great advice, unless you have to kind of walk on eggshells. I don't know that you can let your guard down if you're going to be a comedian now. That might not be the best advice anymore.
Yeah, we've kind of lost our minds as a society. I think it's excellent to have evolving standards. I think any species dies off if it doesn't evolve, of course, but I don't think you hold people accountable for standards that didn't exist back when they were different. That's what demarcates a new era, is when we evolve to new things. It seems so ridiculous to me that people are getting offended by things that the person who was spoke to directly wasn't even offended by. Here's a good rule of thumb. Ask the person who the comment was directed at if they're offended and think the person should be canceled or not. If they're cool, then maybe you should be cool too. Also, don't try to cancel people for statements.
Or let's go a step further. How about just let comedy be comedy, for goodness sakes? And if you don't like it, turn the damn channel or don't buy a ticket to the show. But don't try to ruin someone's life because they made other people laugh and you want to just destroy people's lives because you're a miserable human being that cannot stand to not meddle in other people's business and tear them down.
Well, how do you really feel? Yeah. I do think that, as a legal journalist, I think about the statute of limitations of things, but I also think about retroactivity. And when we create new laws, we don't apply them retroactively. So, Ben Glebe, the presidents have said a lot worse and they haven't been canceled. It's very confusing walking this navigation now.
Well, if you're a president, you can do whatever you want. You don't have to make sense. You can say offensive things. That seems to be something that boosts you in the popularity ratings. But as a host and a comedian, it's very different. Look, I was up for this job to host Jeopardy. I was texting with Mike, and he said that he had put me on the list for hosts, and that they ended up, the group that was in charge decided that I wasn't a right fit. It benefits me that he was taken out of this job. So I'm not saying this out of any obligation, but I feel bad for him. He was a very good host. He was given the job, and for statements that were made a long time ago, he wouldn't have been fired if it weren't for the insane uproar that came around it and the distraction that came from that.
5 seconds. And also, Five seconds left, real quickly. Go ahead.
I was going to say, don't. Also, just look at people's hypocrisies. They were fine keeping him as executive producer, not host. What is that message? As long as people don't see him, we're okay with offensive behavior? It's really because it's not that offensive, and it's just about public outcry.
I had 5 seconds, Ben Ferguson. I was going to ask you for your prediction on who the next host was going to be, but now I'm out. So I'm sorry for that.
Ben Ferguson.
I'll take it and I'll get canceled.
Bye, guys.